So if you turn to 2 Samuel chapter 21, please, verse 1 to 14. 2 Samuel chapter 21, verse 1 to 14. All right, I'm just going to read through that passage. It says, I'm going to be reading from the New King James. It says, "Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, and after that year, and David required of the Lord, and the Lord answered, 'It is because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house, because he killed the Gibeonites.' So the king David called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. The children of Israel had sworn protection to them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the children of Israel and Judah. Therefore David said to the Gibeonites, 'What shall I do for you? And with what shall I make atonement, that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord?' And the Gibeonites said to him, 'We will have no silver or gold from Saul or from his house, nor shall you kill any man in Israel for us.' So he said, 'Whatever you say, I will do for you.' Then they said to the king, 'As for the man who consumed us and plotted against us, that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the territories of Israel, let 7 men of his descendants be delivered to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord chose.' And the king said, 'I will give them.' But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. So the king took Armoni and Mephibosheth, the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah, whom she bore to Saul, and the 5 sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, who she brought for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. And they delivered them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them on the hill before the Lord. So they fell, all 7 together, and were put to death in the days of the harvest, in the first days, in the beginning of barley harvest. Now Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock, from the beginning of harvest until the late rains poured on them from heaven. And she did not allow the birds of the air to rest on them by day, nor the beasts of the field by night. And David was told what Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah, the concubine of Saul, had done. And then David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from the men of Jabesh Gilead, who had stolen them from the street of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hung them up, after the Philistines had struck down Saul in Gilboa. So he brought up the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from there, and they gathered the bones of those who had been hanged. And they buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan his son in the country of Benjamin and Selah, in the tomb of Kish his father. So they performed all that the king commanded, and after that God heeded the prayer for the land." Trust that God would bless the reading of his word this evening. So we've been following the story of Mephibosheth so far. At 5 years old, Mephibosheth was dropped the same day that his father and grandfather died at war with the Philistines. He was dropped and he became crippled. He was lame in both his feet. David became the king, and Mephibosheth at 5 years old, he was taken into exile, taken into hiding, and he lived in Lodibar, the place of no pasture. Then many years later, David is the king, and he asks Ziba the servant, "Who is left of the house of Saul, that I might show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" So eventually Ziba says, "Well, there's a fellow called Mephibosheth, but he's lame." And David said, "Fantastic, bring him." Mephibosheth comes, falls down at the throne, and David says, "You can get up, you're going to be the one who sits at my table and inherit all that was Saul's." And Mephibosheth is just blown away by this grace. And then a few years later, David is removed from, or walks out away from the throne, because Absalom, his son, invades the land and has an uprising and tries to take the throne. And David leaves quietly with his men. Ziba lies to David and Mephibosheth, and tells David that Mephibosheth is secretly plotting against him for the throne. David comes back eventually after Absalom's death, asks Mephibosheth why he didn't come with him, and Mephibosheth explained, as unshaved and unwashed, even his feet weren't cared for, he said, "I was tricked, I'm so sorry." And then David split the land between between Ziba and Mephibosheth. So that's where we are so far. Now we're in this final section of Mephibosheth's life. This is the last little thing we see about Mephibosheth. And he doesn't really play a vital role here. It's actually the lack of the role he plays that's what we kind of want to look at this evening. But just to go through a few points then, some backstory. So like we've done previously, we want to tell the story and then kind of look and see, draw some meaning from the story as well. So in verse 1 to verse 2, we see there's a famine. In verse 1 to 2, there's a famine. And the famine was there because Saul had slain innocent blood. So there's a 3-year famine. And there was this tribe of people within the land of Israel called the Gibeonites. And the Gibeonites were not Israelites. They were already in the land of Canaan. And what they did about 400 years before this event here in 2 Samuel is they tricked the Israelites into making a promise. And the promise was that the Israelites would not kill the Gibeonites. So they made a promise. And then the Gibeonites were like, oh, by the way, like, we were only pretending to be people from far away. We actually live pretty close. But the promise had already been made. The covenant had already been given. And so the Israelites were not allowed to kill the Gibeonites. That was a covenant that they'd made before God, that they wouldn't kill the Gibeonites. Saul, however, according to these verses, when he was king, he tried to kill them all and get rid of them from the land. There's no other record of this in the Bible except here. But what we're seeing here is that Saul, in his zeal for Israel, apparently, misguided zeal, by the way, in his misguided zeal for Israel, he sought to get rid of the Gibeonites completely from the land. So what is this suggesting is that there was a massacre here. Now, we don't know when this happened or what exactly happened, but we know there was a massacre where many Gibeonites were slaughtered, innocent lives were taken, many people were killed at the hands of Saul and his army, and perhaps at the hands of some of his family members as well, as they all went and invaded. Now, there's a famine because innocent blood's been slain, and that's a biblical principle. A biblical principle is that God would not allow the rain to fall upon the land. He would not allow the crops to grow if innocent blood was being slain and nothing was being done about it. It was an act of wrath. It was a chastening of the Lord, that the Israelites were not doing right, and therefore God's blessing would be removed until they did right again. So the first year of famine comes, and David's like, oh, it must be something. It's been a famine. That's not good. So he prays. He seeks the Lord. Second year of famine. Oh, this isn't good. I mean, God promised us that if we're obedient to him and we obey his covenant, that he'll pour abundantly upon this land. He'll pour blessing upon blessing, so much so that the land will be full of crop, that we'll have to sell it. We've got too much. But the second year of famine comes, and he's thinking, what's wrong here? The third year of famine comes, and this is extremely rare. There shouldn't be 3 years of famine in the land of Israel that God has promised to bless. So when there's 3 years of famine, you know something's up, something's wrong. And David knows something's wrong. So he comes to the Lord and he asks, what's happened? What have we done as a nation? What's going on? And God tells him in verse 1, it's because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house, because he killed the Gibeonites. So innocent blood had been spilt, and therefore the innocent lives, the blood that's been spilled, was calling out for vengeance. We see that throughout Scripture. God sees the blood being spilt, and he hears the cry for vengeance. He hears the cry of spilled blood calling out for justice. Okay, you see that in Genesis chapter 4. You see it in Genesis chapter 9. The spilling of innocent blood cries out for justice and vengeance. And God hears that, and God will act. Okay. Now, the second thing then we see is verse 3 to 6, where David comes to the Gibeonites. So David comes to the king. He says, all right. So it's been 3 years of famine. We've come to the Lord. The Lord told us that Saul tried to slaughter all of you. So what can we do to make it right between us? What can we do to fix this so that you'll bless us and the wrath of God, the chastisement of God, will be lifted from the nation? And the Gibeonites say, well, we don't want your money. So it's not about silver. We don't want any of the money in verse 4. We'll have no silver or gold from Saul. We don't want any of his money or possessions. And then he says, nor shall you kill any man in Israel for us. So what he's saying here is we're not wanting personal vengeance. This is not we're going to act with our emotions and our wrath and just get personal vengeance. So this is not an injustice. This is something that's right here. So David says, well, what is it that we can do? And they say, well, what we believe is the right thing to do is that 7 men who are the sons of Saul would be killed. And after they're killed, they'll be hung upon the tree as a mark of them being cursed. Okay, so this is following Deuteronomy. If you know the book of Deuteronomy, it talks about how that when someone hangs upon a tree, it's a mark that they're cursed by God. Cursed is he that hangs upon the tree. And so these men are going to be killed and then hung on a tree before God's face, taking the wrath of God, so to speak, taking the curse of God, so that the wrath of the famine could be lifted. Okay, so that's what's going to happen. Now you might think to yourself, that's a bit severe. Like these Gibeonites are calling for the blood of seven men. Like, what's going on here? This is not how we do things in the 21st century. Well, no, it's not. And we're not comparing the 21st century to what happened here in 1000 BC. But what we have to remember before we move on is this is less than what the deserved judgment was. That Saul and his men had slaughtered hundreds, if not thousands, of Gibeonites, and they're only calling for seven men. Okay, so it is less than what was deserved, because blood calls for blood. The biblical principle is you take a life, your life is forfeit, and so seven men is actually less than what's required. What we also need to stress is the judgment shows how serious the crime is. If I was to say to you, if I was having a chat with you one day and I said, listen, I was just reading in the newspaper the other day, somebody got 25 years of life in prison, you would automatically think to yourself, wow, what did they do? They must have done something serious. So the severity of the punishment shows the severity of the crime. And the fact that there was death being called for shows how serious this crime was, that Gibeonites were being slaughtered as a people. Okay, so that's what we have. David comes to the Lord. The Lord says it's Saul's house. He's killed the Gibeonites. And the Gibeonites says, we want seven of the sons of Saul to take the wrath of God, essentially. That they'll be the sword of God in this situation. So then we get to verse 7, okay? Now, imagine being Mephibosheth at the dinner table that night. You're sitting there with King David and his sons, and you're saying, how's your day been, Mephibosheth? Oh, it's been fine, blah, blah, blah. Did this, looked after it, went and seen the land, talked to Siba a little bit, everything's great. How was your day, King David? Well, actually, I went and prayed to the Lord, and, the high priest said that it's because of the house of Saul, the fact that he mastered the Gibeonites, that's why we have had this famine for 3 years. Oh, right. And what did the Gibeonites say? Well, they just said that seven of the descendants of Saul had to die. Oh, right. Well, that would be me then, right? So that's him. He's one of those men. He's one of the ones who would be the first in line. I mean, the son of Saul was Jonathan, the warrior prince, the famous son of Jonathan, or of Saul, and then his son, Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth's life is now forfeit. Like, he's one of the seven. Surely he's going to be listed. But look what verse 7 says. It says, but the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. So Mephibosheth was actually in line for being killed and being hung upon a tree as the cursed one of God. But because of a promise that was made previously, because of a relationship that was forged previously, Mephibosheth is actually spared. So even though he should have been chosen to be one of these seven men, his life was spared because of a promise made to Jonathan. Now, there's a few beautiful things here, but because of his relationship with another, he was saved. Because Mephibosheth was united to Jonathan by blood, right? So just figuring this one a little bit. Because he was united to Jonathan by blood, he was spared, okay? He was going to be okay because he was connected to the loved one of David, the best friend of David, Jonathan. And because of the promise of another, he was saved, the promise of David. So his blood connection to Jonathan and the promise of David is what saved him. You see that? I hope you're catching something here before I have to say it. But the relationship he had with Jonathan and the promise of David is what spared him. Not his own actions, not his own deeds, not his own abilities or his own credit, but who he was connected to is what rescued him. And then finally, we see the death in verse 8 to verse 14. Seven more descendants were taken, the sons of Saul, the grandsons of Saul, and were handed over to the Gibeonites. They were then killed, and then they were hung on a tree to show that they were the cursed ones of God. They were facing the wrath of God on behalf of the nation of Israel. Okay, I mean, it was the deserved wrath, but on behalf of the nation, so the curse would be lifted. Now, the mother of two of these men sat with her unburied sons as they hung upon the tree. So usually you take the body off the tree on the nighttime, but these bodies were laid bare to hang upon these trees because God's wrath was being shown to be upon these men at this time. And this woman, every day she would sit and she would wait. And any birds that came, any carrion birds, she would run them off. And any beasts that came, she would run them off until the day that the rain came. So she was waiting and watching to see if God's wrath was going to be lifted, because they had taken the wrath of God on behalf of Israel. And when the rain fell, then she was able to leave. And David then took Saul's bones, Jonathan's bones, and the bones of these seven men and buried them with honor. Okay. So what's our story in light of this? And I hope I'm not tearing this story apart to try and bring some application, but I just want to bring a few things out to search through here this evening. So first of all, this, through the sin of another, famine and death has come upon us all. Through the sin of another, famine and death has come upon us all. And I'm sure I don't have to say the names, but that's Adam. When Adam fell in the garden, he brought the whole human race down with him. He was the representative head of all of humanity, called to have dominion and leadership and stewardship over creation. And when he fell, we fell with him, and we fell in him. And we are not just innocent, though. So he fell and brought us all with him. But then we continually show that rebellion through our acts of sin and disobedience as well. So Saul's sin brought curse and famine upon the whole nation. And the sin of another has brought curse and famine upon us as a human race as well. So that's what we see, first of all. Second of all, this sin, this curse, it calls for wrath from God. Okay, so God's wrath is upon the nation here, and God's wrath is upon humanity here. God is a just, righteous, holy God, and his wrath is against sin and is against sinners. There's a very known, well-known phrase that God hates sin and loves the sinner. Although that is to a degree true, there are Psalms that says he despises, he hates, sinners are an abomination. He is furious with sin. And you might not like the idea of a God who's angry, but if God is truly a God of love, he must also be a God of anger. Because if he truly loves with all purity, he's going to hate oppression. He's going to hate injustice. He's going to hate corruption. He's going to hate abuse. If your God does not hate abuse, then your God is a passive, apathetic God. He's not a God of love, okay? And that's really important to stress. So his anger and his judgment is against sin, and it's against our sin. And that judgment will come when Christ returns. But number three, so we see the fall of man here. We see the judgment of God. And number three, we see a picture of Christ. Now, Christ is such a perfect person, and is what he's done in salvation is so great and so marvelous that sometimes the picture needs to be painted with different images so that it can all connect. For example, the scapegoat on the day of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, both rams signify what Jesus did. One ram was sacrificed and his blood was sprinkled upon the throne. The other ram, the sin was confessed upon his head, and then he was released into the wilderness. Both those rams picture what Jesus did, because he was slain and he removed our sin from us. So both picture what Jesus did. We see as well with the prophet, priest, and king, that Jesus is both prophet, priest, and king. He's all three of those. And yet it's such a great, marvelous picture that it needs to sometimes be shown by three people rather than just one person. And here in this story of Mephibosheth, Jesus is represented by the three people here as well. So first of all, Jesus Christ is represented by David, who gave a promise. King David. He is the seed of David. He's the son of David. Jesus Christ, the son of David, the root of Jesse. And he gave a promise to Mephibosheth that you will sit at my table. And he gave a promise to Jonathan that your descendants will be blessed by me and not cursed. And Jesus Christ has given similar promises to us. Not only did David give one to Mephibosheth, but Jesus has given one to us as well. Where I am, you will be. I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. That's not just in this world, but that's in eternity to come. He's bringing us to eternity. I will never leave you nor forsake you is the promise of Christ. I give you eternal life. These are his rich promises. So he is David, given the rich promise, but also he is a type of Jonathan here, because it's through Jonathan that Mephibosheth is saved. It's because of his blood connection to his our father Jonathan, that Mephibosheth deceived, not through merit of his own. And through our blood connection to Jesus Christ, his own precious blood, we are saved from the deserved wrath that is ours, from judgment and from justice. We are spared from these things. But also, there's a third picture of Jesus here as well. He is the one who hung on the tree. When Mephibosheth was spared, it surely entered Mephibosheth's mind. So there were six people, and then there was me. But because it won't be me, there's going to be another person hanging on that tree. So Mephibosheth should have been one of those men hanging on the tree. But David says, I'm not putting you on the tree. I'm going to make sure that you're spared. You're not going to die here, Mephibosheth. I give my word to you, and I give my word to your father. You're not going to die. And it must have entered Mephibosheth's mind. So another one of my relatives has to go on the cross. Another one has to hang upon the tree in my place. And so how can we not see Jesus Christ here as a type of the one who, instead of us taking the wrath of God, instead of us hanging upon the tree, instead of us receiving the judgment and the crucifixion, someone had to take our place, and that's Jesus Christ. I think it's really fitting that Mephibosheth was spared, but another Mephibosheth took his place. If you'll see that, if you'll just look down at verse 8, so the king took Armani and Mephibosheth, the two sons of Rizpah. So there's another Mephibosheth in the line of in his family line. There's two Mephibosheths, and one of them was spared and one of them had to die. And I just find that so fitting that Jesus Christ took, it's such a beautiful picture of Christ taking my sin record upon himself, taking my guilt, my shame, my blame, my wrath upon himself, my death, took all of that upon him so that I would be spared. And then finally, so we saw that the just like Saul's sin brought the fall upon others, we see that Adam brought it. Then we saw the judgment of God, and we see a type of Christ here in these three different people, David, Jonathan, and the one who hangs on the tree. And then finally, we see this, number four, through their death, the wrath of God was lifted from the nation, and the famine was ended. Through their death, the wrath of God was lifted from the nation, and the famine was ended. And we see that through the death of Jesus Christ, the same has come to us. The wrath of God has been lifted from me because the wrath of God was placed upon another. The famine of my life, the darkness and the sin and the bondage and slavery to all that was death has been ended. And now I am free to walk a new life in Jesus Christ. So, there we go. This is what I wanted to bring your attention to this evening. And I've said this before, and just to say it again before we bring all of Mephibosheth to a close here. But God cannot forgive sin. And John, I know, is not the running and hit me this time. Last time I said that, he ran at me. But God cannot forgive sin. And you're like, whoa, that's the whole message of the gospel. No, the message of the gospel is that God can forgive sinners. It's not that he forgives sin, but he forgives sinners. He forgives me of my sin, but he can't just forgive sin and act like it never happened. Sin must be dealt with. Sin must be punished. The wrath of God must be expiated upon somebody. And Jesus Christ was the one who took that upon himself so that sinners could be forgiven. So I hope this gives you call to rejoice. I hope it gives you call to remember who you are in Jesus Christ. You are sealed. You're his, you're spared from the wrath that's to come because of his death, his promise, and his relationship with you. Again, just to say that one more time, you're spared and you're saved because of his death, because of his promise, and because of his relationship to you, as seen here in the story of Mephibosheth. Amen.